Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets, a family podcast of pirates and penguins. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, our adventures near and far, as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
You'll excuse me if occasionally you hear me try to cough off mic. I'm dealing with whatever the funk is. Whatever illness, I call it the funk, is going through our family right now. Because September is, as you just said.
September is the cruelest month.
It is.
It's not April.
It's not April. Apparently, we found out that September, in addition to having new allergies, allergies is a relatively new thing for me as an adult. I didn't have a lot of allergies as a kid. But as I got older, I think because I lived in Steubenville for 4 years, it really messed with my respiratory system that I'm more susceptible to allergies. So what we've heard is that that late September is the worst time of year for asthma sufferers. Excuse me. And that's been bearing out. So I've got some allergy thing going on. We think there might be a cold too, right?
You know, it's hard to tell the difference between colds and allergies, and this is also
a very, very mild cold.
Right. This is also cold season, but we have a sneaking suspicion that maybe there is a very mild cold that isn't causing any other symptoms except runny noses and coughs.
Coffee coughs. So I've got to replenish my supply of CVS sugar-free honey lemon menthol cough suppressant drops. So that I can actually do my job and podcast without coughing constantly. But the real sufferer in this so far has been Ben. I think we mentioned last week that he's been suffering, and
he's pretty much been suffering since the beginning of the month. Poor kid.
And it got to the point where, like, yesterday, so today's Sunday, yesterday, Saturday, we were supposed to go to a scout event called We Below Woods, which it's supposed to be a weekend of camping, but the council kept reducing it in length from over an overnight to a day to a shorter day because of an eastern equine encephalitis threat, which I guess if you're not from around here, if you're not from the eastern part of the U.S., you might not know about it, but it's a mosquito-borne disease that causes brain swelling and can be fatal. And if you survive it, you can be permanently impaired for life. So really
not
bad.
Not something that you want to risk getting.
Yes, exactly. So they kept reducing it so that we wouldn't be out and about around mosquito time. And then, so we were still going to go. And then I got up Saturday morning, we were ready to go, and he just was miserable. And I just called it. You called it, really. There was no way we could get him to go. It would be mean to force him to do it.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, poor thing. He just can hardly breathe right now.
So we stayed home, and it was actually a beautiful day to hang out. I mean, I would have liked to be in the woods, but it was a really nice day to hang out. Because we were going to do that all day, I didn't have anything else planned, so it was nice. And then, but today, well, let's go back in time. I'm going to go back in time to last week. Last Wednesday, you went on a nature walk with the kids for like a homeschool outing.
Yeah. So if one of my homeschool friends has, organized a series of weekly nature walks. Every Wednesday, she picks a different location and an activity. And the goal is to get the kids out in nature and also working on nature journaling. And we missed the first 2 weeks because of illness, unfortunately. But this week, we were doing a pond and vernal pool exploration.
What is a vernal pool?
So a vernal pool is really cool. I'd never heard of
them. You rhymed that. You're a poet.
Oh, yeah. I'd never heard of them until I moved here. But a vernal pool is a body of water which only exists for part of the year. That would be in the spring. That's the name vernal.
Like the vernal equinox.
Right. And vernal pools are really cool because they tend to dry. They fill up in the spring from like rainwater and snow melt. And then they usually dry up by the end of the summer. And because they dry up, they don't have fish in them, which means that they're really good breeding places for frogs and salamanders because there's no fish to eat the to be prey on the eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And so vernal pools are defined in part because they by the fact that they disappear, but also because in what breeds there. And so frogs and salamanders breed in vernal pools.
Cool.
But we had quite the adventure finding our vernal pool and pond. So first of all, my GPS took us to the wrong trailhead. And
where was this located? The
New Bedford?
New Bedford, okay.
Flora
B. Pierce Nature Trail?
Yes.
Okay, I'm looking at a calendar.
Yeah, so for some reason, I put that into the GPS. It took us to a nature trail, but it was about 10 minutes away from the actual nature trail that we were supposed to be meeting at. So I thought it was kind of weird because we were running late on Wednesday morning. We were there 10 minutes after the nature walk was supposed to start, and we were the only one in this parking lot. So uh-oh. I'm like kind of on the fly trying to figure out via my cell phone, like looking up the address on Facebook again and then retyping it into the GPS. This time I typed the actual street address as opposed to the name of the nature trail. And yeah, it was 10 minutes away.
I have found that when you're trying to find nature trails or parking, you know, entrances and that sort of stuff for outdoorsy places, that the names of the places, when you put those into GPS type maps, they often are not the right place. And I think part of it is because a lot of them have multiple ways into the nature areas, and the original people with GPSs tended to be these nature-y people, and they would just label whatever their favorite entrance was, whatever their favorite trailhead or whatever, as the place.
I think that might possibly be it. Like maybe the place where we were was actually a trailhead for this nature trail,
mm-hmm.
like for the other side of the park or something. Although it really didn't feel like it was the same park.
Okay.
But who knows? I didn't look closely at the map when I got back home to see what had happened. So we got there, but they had had a story time where she'd brought some books to read to the kids. And so she had been reading them. And so we got there actually after the story time had finished, but before they'd actually started the hike. So that worked out really well. So then we started our hike. We found what we thought was the vernal pool, and all the kids used their nets to dip out samples of water. We found some water bugs. We looked at them under some magnifying lenses. The nature journaling didn't really happen. One kid's mother was really on top of it and got him to get out his nature journal, and none of the other kids did. They were much more interested in wading into the water and splashing.
Right.
Right. Now, the interesting thing was that while we were standing on the edge of this pool, I noticed that there was a sign which somebody had thrown into the water. And I kind of was curious about that, but I couldn't get into it myself, not having boots like the kids had. I couldn't wade out. And the kids were all much too distracted. So I thought that was interesting. So we finished there and we decided to go find the vernal pool. And so we walked and we walked and we walked and we walked and we walked through the woods until we finally came to a place where we could see the road. Now, looking at our map, we realized that we were on the wrong trail because the trail we were supposed to be on was a loop that didn't go anywhere near the highway.
So, long story short, you went to what you thought was the pond. And that and it turned out that
we thought it was the vernal pool. It turned out that that was the pond.
That was the pond.
Because later, after most of the people had gone home, the two families that were left, ours and one other, went to go find the vernal. What we thought was the pond. But what we found was, in fact, a sign that said, look, this is a vernal pool. And it did indeed look like a vernal pool. So what we had found, which looked like a big mud puddle, was in fact the pond, which was a very disappointingly small pond.
Yeah, the pictures made it looked pretty small. So.
It, it was kind of a mud puddle, really, not a pond.
So in the end, I mean, did you have a good time? Was it a worthwhile trip?
Yeah, it was fun. We got to hang out with friends. We did get to see some interesting fungi on the path. We got a nice walk in the woods.
Everybody loves a fungi.
nobody fell into the water. And
that sounds like a successful trip.
It was a successful trip. Yeah.
And the kids enjoyed themselves.
They did. And I think that they learned something, if nothing else, that ponds can be very small bodies of water.
Well, I love the fact that they're learning about the place that they live. They're learning about the unique, you know, flora and fauna and environment, ecology,
ecosystem
that they live in here in, you know, New England. And but even more specifically, in the area south of Boston, because there is uniqueness even in that range, just that area that we live in here. And it's really neat that they're getting to learn about it. And it's going to be so different from any other place they live in their lives.
Yeah. And it's fun for me, too, because I'm not from around here. I'm from Central Texas.
They have mesas there and there's no grass. I mean, yeah.
No, I'm from the hill country. We have lakes and we have creeks.
They have a lake. Lake Travis? Lake Long?
There's Lake Travis.
And Lake Austin.
Well, it used to be Lake Austin. Now it's Lady Bird
Lake. Lady Bird Lake, named after the movie Lady Bird?
No, after the First Lady.
Sorry, I'm just going to harass you tonight.
Yes, you are really in a mood.
Yep. But yes, it is. But it's very different. I mean, the animals are different. You know, many of the animals are different. There's squirrels in both places. But you know what I mean? Like the birds and that sort of stuff.
It's very, very
sorts of fish.
Very different.
Yeah. I like that. I like that that they're learning about this, which I really didn't learn as a kid. Maybe there was opportunity to learn, but I didn't learn it. You said that Ben was really engaged with.
Yeah,
with
I was really pleased because we had done a vernal pool exploration last year, I think, or maybe it was the year before. And but it's been a while. And I was really pleased because during this sort of intro question and answer session, can anybody tell me what a vernal pool is and what makes it different from a pond? Ben spoke up and he's usually very shy among groups of people. And he actually had the answer right.
I have to say, Ben is really coming out of his shell.
Yes.
He's really starting to interact with and speak for him with people, with adults, and speak for himself. With kids, he's always been fine, but he's always been really shy around other adults. And I've noticed that in whether it's scouts or with Father Michael during altar server training or this, he's really starting to speak up for himself. And I feel it's great because I often have felt like I always was speaking for him and I felt awkward. Like I don't want people to think that I don't let him talk for himself.
Right. And in fact, it can actually make social anxiety worse when you don't
right.
talk for them. So it's been good.
Yeah, I'm really, it's that maturing. He's really, you know, he's at that stage where that sort of maturing is coming out. And I'm really happy to see that. You know, they're all kind of at those different stages. And it's fascinating to see them changing and becoming, you know, the people that they're going to become. So it's neat. So that was the nature walk. That was your first outdoor adventure this week. Today, Sunday, you went on. So the girls' scout troop, BSA Scouts, Troop 13G, G for girls, had their very first outdoor activity with the Weeblos of Pack 56. But because Ben is one of those Weeblos, but because he wasn't feeling well, he stayed home. I stayed home with him. And you went on the hike, which I have to say, I would have liked to have gone. I'm grateful that you went when I asked you to, because today is Sunday afternoon, which is when the Patriots are playing. And I'm not sure why any of these people scheduled this for during Patriots time, but okay. They did, uh-huh. But thank you for going. And I gather you had a good time.
I was really glad to go. This was a really cool nature hike. It's just in like,
The next town over.
I had no idea that this pond was there or this trail was there.
Ponkapog Pond, which it's actually in Canton, my hometown, where
but
I grew
it's
up.
Right over the line.
But it's right over the line.
From Randolph.
Yes.
It's part of the Blue Hills Nature Reservation. And we've done hikes in the Blue Hills before, but on the other side in the hills. And this is just a pond. But what makes it really cool is that it has a bog, a peat bog.
Not just any bog. Yeah. A peat bog, which is I think it's the, what did it, Adam is the one of the Scoutmasters. He said it's the only peat bog in eastern United States. Is that what he said? One of the only?
One of the only. It's a very, yeah.
Rare.
It's rare. There aren't a whole lot of peat bogs left. And it also had some white cedar, which evidently there aren't very many stands of white cedar left. So it was kind of a cool, like, ecosystem that I'd never seen before. I'd never seen actually been walked through a peat bog. So we did a very long loop trail. It went all the way around Ponkapog Pond, which is not a small pond. This was the
A 5 mile loop.
Yeah, I think altogether, my watch said that altogether with all the little side like turns, we did 5 miles.
Yeah. What's the difference between a lake and a pond?
Depth.
Okay. Well, I knew she'd know.
See, a pond does not get any deeper than sunlight can penetrate to the bottom, which means it has a particular ecosystem, whereas lakes get deeper.
Homeschooling moms know everything.
We do, because we go on these nature walks, and even if the kids aren't paying attention, like, I'm taking mental notes so that later when they do ask me for these things, I'll know.
Yes. Well, if you've been listening on our nature walk, so you went to the Ponkapog Pond, did the loop. There was a bog, so there was a boardwalk that went from the trail to the water's edge through the bog.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's a little trail that goes off the main trail, and then you kind of go through the woods, and then you get to a boardwalk. And this boardwalk was maybe like 2 feet wide at the narrow. Well, there are some places that were even narrower, and it had been put in the like late 80s. They're currently renovating it and putting new boards in, but some of the boards were new, and
I'm
some
gonna
of the
guess
boards
that none of those boards are 30 years old, not in a bog.
Well, some of these boards looked like they could be 30 years old. I'm telling you, they were rotting apart. And
so not boards you can stand on.
But there were obviously layers of boards on top of layers of boards on top of layers of boards in some places. So that was kind of, it was cool. So most of the way, like, through the boardwalk is going like through very wet, boggy forest. So there's lots of trees. But in between the trees, the ground is wet, wet, wet. And then there are a few clearings where it sort of opened out and it was just bog and very short
peat bog
and short dwarf white cedars.
Cool.
At some places, the moss, the peat moss was this brilliant red color. So striking. Mm. We were told that there might be carnivorous plants, like...
Well, there's supposed to be, it's supposed to be a breeding place for carnivorous plants in that area.
Right. So, pitcher plants and sundews, we did not see any. We did, some of the hikers saw a frog. Mm. I didn't. Some of the hikers also saw a snake eating a frog.
The boys love that one.
Yeah, I'm sad.
Oh,
that
cool. It's so gross.
One of the moms actually spotted it, but all the and we were unfortunately at that point too far ahead, and mm-hmm. they tried to call us, but the at that point the girls had taken the lead and were way outstripping all the other kids.
That's funny. So, and the girls enjoyed themselves.
The girls had a great time. I mean, they're still in the kind of getting to know you stage, so it was fun for them to have, you know.
It's a small troop. There's only four regular girls.
Five.
Well, there's four girls who have been coming regularly.
Right.
There's a fifth one who came once. Hopefully she'll be coming back again. She'll become a regular member. But and then only three of the girls came, two of them Bella and Sophie, and then this one other girl who came. So it's a small group, which, you know, is nice that they as founding members that they get to know each other well, but it would be nice for it to grow. But yeah, they're still getting to know each other.
Right. And so there's something about like hiking and talking that really helps to break the ice when you're just walking along with mm-hmm. people.
Yep.
So that was really nice.
And it was a beautiful, like a perfect.
It was a perfect fall New England day. Not too hot.
70 degrees, bright sunny skies, a little bit of a breeze.
Yeah, it was gorgeous.
Yeah, that was, I'm, you know, a little sad I didn't get a chance to go, but the Pats game was good. So
I think I'll take the nature walk over the Pats game any day.
I know, and I'll take the Pats game. Good. That sounds awesome. I think that's about it for stuff we've been doing. I mean, we've been doing other stuff than normal day-to-day stuff, which isn't all that interesting. So let's talk about what we've been eating. again, Grandma's visiting still. And so that Grandma likes to take us out sometimes for meals, or we order something in, that sort of thing. So it's more casual. We do sometimes like to, like, it's kind of funny. We'd like to make special meals when someone's visiting, but sometimes because it's an opportunity, we go out too, because your mom would be generous or your dad would be generous and want to take us out to dinner.
We've done some nice meals though.
But we have made some nice things. So this week, you made chili.
I did.
And the eternal question comes up again. Does chili properly have beans or no beans? Now, there are Texans who would say chili does not have beans. You are a Texan.
A lot of Texans say that there is no place for beans in chili. I'm not one of them.
Yeah. A lot of Texans say chili is beef and sauce.
Yeah. I like beans in my chili. I really like beans.
Why not?
Chili. Right.
I mean, as long as they're properly cooked and not hard and, you know, that sort of stuff.
I cheat and use canned beans.
Actually, I don't think canned beans, except in very specific ways, I don't think canned beans are cheating. Because beans are one of those things that requires lots of preparation. And then they are not, in most circumstances, they're not appreciably better or worse than like freshly soaked and cooked beans.
Right.
Now, if you're making, like, say, Boston baked beans, you'd want those from scratch, not canned.
Well, I do buy baked beans.
Well, no, I'm saying, but if you're making Boston baked beans.
Oh, yeah,
you wouldn't use canned beans to make your own baked beans. I mean, to go to all that effort to make baked beans and then use the canned beans, the quality isn't going to be there. It's not going to be the same thing.
Uh-huh.
But if you're, like, making a stew or a chili or a soup or, you know, canned beans are fine.
Yeah, I mean, they're not as cheap as buying dried beans. It's not as economical, but it's not that expensive either. It's right.
You weigh the convenience versus the cost. And yeah. Anyway, so there was an interesting Facebook discussion with one of your friends who's apparently from Texas, or at least lived in Texas in the Army, but who was vehemently anti-bean.
Very anti-bean. But
your chili's good, even though the kids make it so that you have to tone it down a lot.
It's not nearly as spicy as it was these days when it was just you and me eating it.
Oh my gosh. Remember the time we over chilied the.
You had a package of spice that said chili powder. And so I thought it was what I was used to, chili powder. What this was actually like cayenne pepper.
It was ground chili peppers from India, where they call it chili powder. It's powdered chili peppers.
Right. Whereas what I'm used to is a blend of peppers. Some of them are spicy, but some of them are smoky and
with cumin and other stuff in the chili powder. Right.
Yeah.
So you put the straight up chilies in.
I put like 3 tablespoons of this stuff in, and it was potent. Neither one of us could eat it.
We were like trying to figure out how do you cut? We add sour cream. Do you, like, we were trying all kinds of things.
We heroically tried to eat that chili.
It was really good, but way too spicy. That's what it always gets me, is when it's really good, but my body just cannot eat it because it's too spicy.
This has happened to me more than once, mm-hmm. I have to say, accidentally making foods that were way too spicy.
Or accidentally ordering hot wings. The triple extra hurt me hot wing story from Drovers.
That's you.
Yes, that's a lot too long of a story to tell. And I'll put a link to the story on my blog as I've told it before. It is a humorous story, and you should definitely read it. But yeah, so we also had you made salmon the other day.
Yep.
And we had a bit of a disaster in the oven while you were making the salmon.
The salmon itself was fine and was not the culprit.
It didn't suffer as a result, surprisingly.
But one day last week, and I don't even remember what day, it's been so long, I made Indian food. I made curry. Yeah. And I had bought some pre-made naan at the grocery store. That's the Indian flatbread that's kind of like pita. And so I threw those into the oven, and because they're really big and they didn't fit on one baking sheet, I just threw them onto the oven rack, which is a perfectly fine way of cooking them. Unfortunately, we were eating late and I was in a hurry and I wasn't really paying close attention. When I pulled them out of the oven, one of them must have got left behind, shoved all the way into the back, and I didn't notice it.
And
Tragic.
We haven't cooked anything. We didn't cook anything of it in between, huh?
We must not have.
Or if we did, it wasn't. You baked everything. You didn't broil anything. Because it was when you turned on the broiler.
Right. I cooked two things that night. I cooked the salmon, but I also made some squash. When I put the squash in, there was kind of a burny, smoky smell. And I just thought something must have spilled in the oven. And I didn't really pay it much mind.
Right. But then
when the squash came out.
And you put the salmon in under the broiler.
The salmon went in under the broiler. And suddenly.
it was smoky. Like. Our house has bad air circulation, and when we cook, we very often set off the smoke detectors. Even, like, you're broiling, you open the oven up, there's no smoke rolling out or anything, and the smoke detector down the hall will go off. It's just the way it is. It's our house.
Okay? Super, super sensitive smoke detectors.
Well, and it's just super, no air moving around. Okay. But this, open the oven, and a cloud of smoke rolls out.
And it was very acrid, sharp smoke, too. And I could not figure it out because the salmon was on a piece of parchment paper, and the parchment paper was
scorched a little bit.
But you would not expect that a small piece of scorched parchment paper would create that much smoke.
No.
So we ended up decamping and eating on the patio instead of in the dining room because the house was very smoky, very smoky.
Yes.
The whole house.
Oh, my gosh. We had to open all the windows. We had to close all the bedroom doors for the smoke detectors in there so they would stop annoying us. Take down the other smoke detectors that were in the halls and put those into rooms and open all the windows and doors and just wait for it. And then the house stank of that smell for 24 hours until you could cook some other things that would overtake it. So something would vinegar, something you made. Something that was a stronger smell than that.
My banana bread.
Oh, yes, a banana bread. Yep. Or the banana muffins. Yeah.
It's
so
banana bread, just in muffin form.
Okay. So anyway.
I realized I didn't actually realize what had been smoking in the oven until I opened it up to try to find what had spilled. And I'm pulling out the pizza stone, which I store in the bottom of the oven, and looking at it. It doesn't look like anything spilled on it. And then I finally see something on the back of the rack, and it's like a
black disc.
And I thought, at first, I thought maybe I accidentally got an oven mitt in there.
It has happened where we've put a pot down on the counter and then picked it up and put it in the oven, like the big Dutch oven, and a trivet, like a plastic trivet or something, is stuck to the bottom. And melted in the oven. That we had that happen once.
Yeah.
So it's possible. Yeah. So that sort of thing, it's possible. It happens. But it wasn't.
But no, I pulled it out and I looked at it and I'm like, this is a piece of black round charcoal in it. It could only be a piece of bread. It
can only be blackened naan, which is I do not recommend.
No, and not it's very Cajun sad country. Because I love naan and I would have gladly eaten that piece.
Yes. Yeah. So goodbye naan.
And I really think that smell lingering in the house was probably one of the things that did poor Ben.
Right. That was Friday.
Morning.
And then,
it's Saturday morning.
Yeah. So that was Friday night. So overnight and then Saturday morning. Yeah. That probably was not helping.
Yeah.
Poor guy. So
we're trying to give him his allergy medicines in the smoky kitchen and he's just getting worse and worse and worse as I'm trying to make him better by giving him medicine. It was a bad scene.
So that's been, that's the food. We've had a few other things. We had, I grilled some pork chops tonight and some other things, but I don't think anything stands out or is remarkable or worthy of long discussion. You did make a mango salsa that was really good, though, I have to say.
To go with the salmon?
To go with the salmon. That was...
I've discovered the secret to a quick mango salsa. I used to buy mangoes and laboriously, peel them and chop them into pieces. Then I discovered... they sell frozen mango chunks in the freezer section of the grocery store. And I love this because I don't have to deal with the pits. And the skins of mangoes actually give me rash. I'm sensitive to something on the skin. So no rashes.
Sounds good to me.
Yay.
Yay. All right. So let's talk about what we're watching and reading, what we might be watching, too. So I neglected to mention a book that I read last week called Words of Radiance. It's the second book in the Stormlight Archive by Brandon Sanderson. Now, I'm trying to remember if I talked about this series before, but Brandon Sanderson is one of those big sword and sorcery fantasy authors that lots of people talk about that I never got around to reading until recently.
I've never read anything by him.
Okay. And maybe, I mean, he's written a bunch of stuff, but maybe he's relatively new compared to the stuff you've read. So
are you saying that I'm old?
Yes. So, yeah. But I'm older.
That's true.
Excuse me. So the series itself is really good. Although when I first started reading the first book, I was like, I have no idea what's going on. I'm very confused. I'm not sure I want to keep reading it, but I kept reading it. And I kind of finally figured it out because it is such a unique world that he has created, a world where there are these storms that roll through this. It's like a continent, I guess. It's this across this continent from east, west, or west to east on a regular schedule. They can forecast it. And it's so powerful that nothing can survive outdoors in this storm. If a person is not inside a closed, armored sort of location, it'll destroy it. And so all the animal life is armored. There is no real plant life apart from some kinds of trees and other things that, like these, he has invented these vegetation that kind of retracts into shells, and it's fascinating. I love like this amazingly inventive world that he's created, and then there's a kind of magic, and it's connected to a larger world that sort of exists that connects his different series, but only by these larger philosophical concepts. I'm not sure exactly how far it goes because I really haven't read beyond these two books yet, but they're really good. And I hear that they're adapting it for TV, which, you know, or streaming, you know, I'm not sure how I feel about that. There are interesting characters with interesting ideas. I'm not sure how well these things could be carried out by the typical Hollywood people. So we'll see, but really fascinating. I mean, even like the cultural issues, like things like in this one particular culture, women have a free hand and a safe hand, and one of their hands, and I can never remember whether this is the right or the left, but one of their hands must always be covered. If it was to be, if that safe hand was to be uncovered, so they have like inside a sleeve, if it was to be uncovered, it would be like walking around naked. Like women are embarrassed by it.
Okay.
Like even having a glove on where you could see the fingers is somewhat risque.
Okay, so kind of like the mythical Victorian women showing their ankles.
Yes, along those lines. But the other hand is fine. That and in this culture, only women read. Men do not read. Reading is considered to be feminine, effeminate. So they've developed certain glyphs so that men can figure out where they're supposed to be going. So they're more like ideograms.
So interesting,
but they wouldn't read glyphs. They wouldn't read them like a book. That would be unmanly. So that means that women have a lot. They're the engineers. They're the scientists. They're the researchers and teachers. That they must accompany armies into battle because you need someone to be a messenger and you need someone to write things down and be clerks and all that sort of stuff. So it's fascinating. He takes these ideas and he runs them out. I just love when authors spend time to create a world and they delve deep into the aspects of that world, whether or not it bears directly into the story that they're writing right now, you can tell that they've thought about it.
Does this kind of like this series kind of like The Martian, where the story and the plot comes from the constraints that the author has created? Or are those just sort of secondary to the story?
Certainly the constraints that he's created shape the story in very strongly. I mean, the way that the characters have to behave and act and things that happen to them are because of these constraints. It reminds me a lot of Tolkien, the Middle Earth, you know, which is a very large world where there's is always things beyond the border and there's always things in the past. Or Sterling, S.M. Sterling, and his Changeverse or his other worlds that he creates, where, you know, Sterling famously you know, his world is set in, say, North America, but he's thinking about the, you know, the caravan pattern economics in India and how that affects the economics in trading in Australia. And then into the story comes people who trade with Australia, and it tells you something of that comes up. You know what I mean? It's like everything in the world interacts, and he's thought about everything. I mean, obviously not every single thing, but he thinks things to their logical end. He doesn't have loose ends generally. And that's what kind of feels like with this. And I really enjoyed it. It's they're long stories, but they're good stories, and I'm really enjoying it.
Well, I'm kind of fascinated by the idea of constraints, especially. I like the idea of constraint in art. Like,
yep.
Poetry is all about constraints.
Right. And there's a magic system that's connected to gems. Gems are infused with a certain power. Stormlight, which is where the name of the series comes from. When the storm rolls through, it infuses the gems with light, and then that light can be used for different things. It not only is it, they use it for a light source, but they also use it the properties of these gems when they're infused with light. They use that in various, they call them fabrials, elevators, you know, because this fabrial makes things go up and down, that sort of thing. It's just a fascinating series. So I'm enjoying that, and I'm looking forward to book three on that. I also read the latest Stephen Kuntz novel, which is not...
It's like techno spy thrillers?
Yeah, it's more. It's like a clan in the realm of Clancy.
Ah.
And I think it was his last one. The way he ended it...
Like the last one ever, or the last one in a particular series?
It might be. I think he's retiring. He might be. The thing with Kuntz, Stephen Kuntz, is all of the politicians in it are thinly veiled caricatures of real politicians. So, like, for example, the previous president was Barry Sotero. Barack Obama's middle name is Sotero, or like there's a name and it's Barack Obama, but Barry Sotero. Cynthia Hinton previously ran for president. Before that, she was Secretary of State and was married to former President Willie Hinton.
Not very thinly veiled.
Very thinly veiled. And then, you know, there's a Chuck Schumer, and there's a Nancy Pelosi, and Von Conyers is Donald Trump, and so on and so forth. And he sort of plays out these libertarian fantasies situations, is essentially the bad guys are all the liberals that are plotting to destroy America. Our good guys are preventing them. So it's not great. There are better spy thriller series out there. The Mitch Rapp series, the Gray Man series, they're better. Even the Clancy series that are being done by, now that Tom Clancy has died, they're being done by other authors, are better. But I think it's the last one. And so I figured I should read it. So. Because I've been reading a lot of his over the years, but I think Stephen Kuntz has gotten a little crankier in his old age. Mm-hmm. He wrote Flight of the Intruder originally, which was about a Vietnam era attack pilot. And that character has been in all of these, ends up being the director of the CIA now. So that's
I see.
It's the same character throughout all his books. So that's what I've been reading. And also I watched the season premieres of FBI and The Good Place, which I really enjoy. And tonight we're going to the Rookie season premiere. So we'll have to watch that tomorrow night.
Right.
So what are you reading?
I picked up a book from the library, which I sort of intended for Isabella, who loves reading about birds. But I thought it looked interesting enough that I sort of grabbed it off of the pile because she hadn't got to it yet. It's called The Thing with Feathers. Which the title itself kind of intrigues me because it's a reference to an Emily Dickinson poem, Hope is the Thing with Feathers.
Of course.
But it's about birds, not about Hope or Dickinson. and it's by this guy who is a naturalist who is interested in sort of what bird behavior can tell us about human behavior. And so that's sort of the hook. And then each chapter is sort of about a different bird species, but also looking at a specific sort of behavior. So the first chapter is about birds, the homing birds. like homing pigeons, of course, he spends a lot of time with. But then he also talks about these seabirds whose name I can't remember. Manx shearwater. That's what they are.
Very good.
So these Manx shearwater have been known to find their way home from great distances. So for an experiment, he gave a Manx shearwater to a friend who was traveling from England to Boston. And this guy carried him the shearwater on the plane with him in a shoebox under the seat, which would not fly. It wouldn't fly these days, but at the time it did. And so then the guy got off at Logan Airport, took the shearwater out, like with some help from people who were at the airport. He walked out and let it go. And the author was shocked at how quickly the shearwater got to back to Wales. It was evidently flying something like 100, 200 miles a day. Wow. Like he thought that his friend had actually made a mistake and let it go in London as opposed to taking it across the Atlantic to Boston. It got home so fast.
Wow.
And then there was a thing about penguins and why penguins are afraid of the dark. And there was a chapter about vultures, which was like vultures can evidently eat anything. They can eat botulism, anthrax, hantavirus, and they neutralize it all.
Well, when you think about it, they eat dead stuff. And so therefore, like stuff that has carrion, they eat. And so that stuff will usually be carrying disease of some sort or another. And so the ones that survive that are the ones that they pass on their immunity.
And at the risk of grossing out our listeners, the thing I found most fascinating and the tidbit I ended up sharing at dinner.
Much
to everyone's dismay was that vultures' excrement is actually sterile. There is nothing in it. And in fact, they use it to sterilize their own legs because their legs, of course, tend to be in the carrion. The excrement actually kills off any bacteria that are lingering on the vultures.
I'm just picturing a listener listening to our podcast during their lunch break and then sitting back and pushing the tray away.
But I'm really,
I mean, it is fascinating, that idea,
right?
That it's clean. Their excrement is clean. It won't, if you get it on you, it's not going to, they can't pass a disease onto you through their excrement.
Right. And you would think, you think vultures, those have got to be like the filthiest, grossest birds. Like you don't want to be near them. And yet it turns out that, in fact, they really are nature's cleanup crew, and they get rid of things that otherwise would kill other animals.
That's fascinating. You also told me something about hummingbirds that you talked about, that their hearts beat every, like
a hummingbird's heart when it's flying beats something like 1,200 times a minute.
Wow.
A minute. That's, but
that's how fast my heart beats when I'm around you.
So they have the quickest metabolism of any animal that we've ever found. Which is why they're constantly eating. Like they are right on the limit of how much energy a living organism can consume. But the interesting thing I found was that hummingbirds actually go almost comatose at night when they're sleeping. Their metabolism slows down almost to the other opposite extreme to conserve energy. So that a hummingbird asleep cannot be woken up. Like it's almost dead.
Oh, wow.
That was kind of cool.
More jokes. That's interesting. Yeah.
So this has been a fun book. The funny thing was that until I became a homeschooling mom, I didn't really like reading nonfiction very much. As a kid, I was always like the fiction section for me. And I only read nonfiction grudgingly when teachers made me do it. But now as an adult, I've come to really like books like this. Like, I don't know where all the good nonfiction was when I was a kid, but evidently it was hiding.
Interesting. Yeah, I agree. I have begun to really enjoy the sorts of books that tell you about the fascinating stories of ordinary things. like Mark Kurlansky's books, like about oysters or salt or milk or like just these average normal things. But yet they have fascinating stories. And in fact, they changed some aspects of them, changed the world. Coffee changed the world because of coffee houses in Europe that for the rise of democracy and that sort of stuff. But you're right. I've only really come to appreciate that as an adult.
One thing I'm liking about homeschooling, though, is that I'm getting to pass on this newfound love of nonfiction to the kids. So they don't have the prejudice against nonfiction that I had. Mm. Like to them, they've always heard stories that are like really interesting, well-written nonfiction because I've mm-hmm. gone out of my way to try to find really good stuff to read to them.
Right. When I was in high school, I did read a lot of history. I liked especially World War II history. So I did like some nonfiction. So let's move on to talk about something that we've been talking about this week. We have this issue that's come up with Sophie's 11 heading toward 12 in the spring, right? 12?
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. And it's about time. It's about the same time when we decided that Bella should have a computer that she can use to do her schoolwork.
Right. It's getting to the point where composition is starting to happen like more at length, and I want them to do writing. And
then we have Rosetta Stone, where she could be doing her French on with an app. And
yeah, if she ever consents to,
but she might if she's got the computer. That was one of the things,
right?
But yeah, so there's more and more things that she could be. And we've got iPads and laying around. We've got computers, but really, there needs to be something that's just for her work. Now, when Bella was in need, I came into possession of a Chromebook for review that we could keep after when I was done reviewing it. And before that, I would not have even thought about a Chromebook, but this was an okay Chromebook. It does the Google apps pretty much. That's about it. And, and does web stuff. And it's worked for Bella. She uses it, she uses Google Docs to write things. She has an email that she communicates with you and some of her friends. She uses Hangouts or Skype or whatever to talk with distant friends here and there. So it's worked out for her. She loves Google Maps, by the way.
She could spend hours on Google Maps.
The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. I loved maps as a kid and atlases, and especially National Geographic maps. So yeah, she loves exploring places, getting down into the street view and like really seeing the places.
Yeah. And then she also likes to navigate to places where she's actually been on Google Street View. So like she'll find her way to like Uncle John's house or to the farmer's market by going down Google Street View and like making all the turns. That's fascinating to me as a person who is not, as a person who is not very good at maps. I don't know. She must have totally got that skill from you.
Yes, she's actually has a really good sense of direction. So, yeah, she must have got that from me. So then the question is what do we do for Sophie? Do we get her a Chromebook? Do we get her an iPad? An iPad with a keyboard attached. A MacBook, we could. It's more expensive. I mean, I hate to say it, but it's really where we are. But even Apple's really pushing the iPad with a keyboard attached as the school computer. They've got advertising and that sort of stuff. So that's the question. And the price is a similar. I mean, you could get really cheap Chromebooks, but I don't want a really cheap Chromebook. That's just more hassle than it's worth. So the price is about the same between them. And so we've been going back and forth on this, the pros and cons. And Sophie, when we approach her, would you rather an iPad or a Chromebook? She really prefers the iPad.
Yeah. I think she has this idea that maybe we can let her put some games on it.
Well, yeah, we might. There's only one of the iPads that the kids have regular access to that can play Alto's Odyssey, which is one of her favorite games. So
there might be a little bit of an ulterior motive in that choice.
Now, that said, I think of anyone, Sophie is the one we can trust to abide by the rules and only play it when we tell her she can play it.
She tends to be a rule follower, although, kids, you give a kid a temptation and just because she hasn't yet been tempted past what she doesn't mean that there isn't something that could tempt her.
We can monitor it, and I know what tools there are to put limits on certain things, which is the one of the pros of iPads is I know them inside out and backward and forward. I can manage it for us, and she would only have, you know, she'd be able to do the things that only that she could do. So there's that. A Chromebook has some benefits. It has an actual real physical keyboard. That's really the big benefit.
Right.
The iPad, you know, the iPads are out there. It would come with a Apple Pencil, or we could get one. It has the camera, can do FaceTime and Skype and all that sort of stuff. You could put Audible on it.
And she could, yeah, you could put Audible on it, and she could use it as a Kindle. Which, yep. Because we've also talked about, like, getting Sophie a Kindle.
Right, but this could be her Kindle. Doesn't have the battery life of a Kindle, but she'd have to plug it in a lot more often.
I mean, probably eventually she actually needs a Kindle, too.
Yeah, yeah. So, that would be the fourth Kindle in the family. We're going to really have Kindles everywhere. So, I think, though, we've come down to iPad, right?
It sounds like that's probably what's going to happen.
Yeah, yeah. So, I'm going to wait a little bit. There's some rumors that Apple's going to have another iPad event in October. So I want to see all their cards on the table. They introduced one at the iPhone event in September. So that may be the one, but we'll see what comes out, and maybe there'll be something I want and I'll hand off my iPad Pro to her.
Uh-huh.
We did have an incident with one of the other iPads, the older iPads, where she was carrying it out the door and dropped it, you know, she like through the patio door and dropped it and shattered the screen. And she was very upset. I was upset at first. I think to my credit, I calmed down, told her it was okay. And that I'm glad that it was this one and not a new one or my one that is mine for work and personal. Now you know why we don't carry it with it open. We always have the cover closed on it. Because this was one that had a cover that would protect it if she dropped it. So she was upset, but she calmed down and she recognized. And so maybe that was a good learning lesson, an expensive one, but a good learning lesson. So I'm going to take it with me to the Apple store and see how much it would cost to replace the screen. iPad screens are kind of expensive, I think. Because they're so big. So we'll see. It would be nice. Because it's a pretty capable iPad. So that's our big question. And actually, if any of you listeners have gone through this with your kids, you know, 12, 13, preteen, you know, the first computer, or do you do computers for your kids? Do you have a family computer that sits in the one place in the house where they always sit with it? That's one of the rules we try to enforce is that, you know, when Bella's done with her computer, it comes back into the office and it gets plugged in there every night. It's, you know, although I recognize the need for sometimes she needs some privacy to talk to her friends on it or some privacy where she's not around her brothers and sisters who are distracting her. But
right. If she's using it for school and writing, she's very distractible. And so having lots of people around talking to her makes it hard. So you want her to have quiet. And at the same time, we recognize that there are dangers as kids get older of having devices
in their rooms, behind closed doors. Yeah. Right. So that's going to be something we're going to have to navigate. I think the key is going to be just, you know, educating her about, you know, about things that you shouldn't do and should do and that sort of stuff, especially when it comes to the internet. She doesn't really go on the internet.
Right.
Yeah, apart from like Google Maps and the Google apps she uses, she doesn't surf.
Right. We haven't really done the using a web browser lessons yet.
I've locked down the internet on her browser, so anytime she goes to a new site, I have to give her explicit permission to go to it. So there is that. But yeah, so as we get further along this path, I'd love to hear what you have done as listeners. As parents, though, I'd love to hear what the listeners have done with your kids and what your decisions have been. It would would help us give us more information. We could share that with the audience, and we'd all maybe benefit from your hard-won experience and wisdom. So, and if you would like to do that, you can contact us at Betts, B-E-T-T-S, at sqpn.com. You can send an email there. You could actually record a voice memo on your phone using the memo function and email that. That would be awesome. I'd love to play your feedback during the podcast. That'd be fun. Or you can go to our website, sqpn.com/Betts, B-E-T-T-S, or to the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia, and you can leave comments on our show there. And I'll put also make sure I put some links to the things we mentioned in the show in our show notes at sqpn.com. Anything else, Melanie, before we
wrap up? No, I don't think so.
Yeah, it's you're very tired, I know, from a long day of hiking.
5 miles.
how many steps on your watch?
It was like 13,000 steps.
So,
yeah.
And your hurt. Exercise ring went around a few times.
I think 4.
Good. That's good exercise. So if you can remember to like Raising the Betts, the podcast episodes on our StarQuest Facebook page, if you can retweet them on Twitter at SQPN, that's our Twitter handle, and leave comments, that helps with the algorithms to get the show out there to a larger audience. We really do appreciate that. If you can share the show and we can grow this community of listeners. So until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Betts on StarQuest.